Off the Ball Daily.
A home for your favourite podcasts from Off the Ball.
My memory is when something was is based on sporting events. How do you know that was 2009? Oh, that was the year Ireland won the Grand Slam. It's like, oh, weird.
Subscribe to the Off the Ball Daily podcast feed right now.
Football on Off the Ball.
With William Hill. Who you got? 18 plus. See gamblingcare.ie.
This is News Talk.
Now, we do want to turn to the WSL because certainly in the Premier League we have ourselves a title race, and in the WSL we most certainly have a title race, and what's more, it's really at the business end of proceedings now because there are just five games left and Chelsea and Manchester City are locked on 43 points apiece. Their goal difference is very tight as well. Arsenal are 6 points back, so think really we're saying two-horse race more than likely. For more on this, Rachel O'Sullivan is with us from Girls on the Ball. Rachel, hello.
Good evening, how are you?
Good. So, give us a sense of the season thus far. I can tell people that there is a fairly identical look to Chelsea and Manchester City form in that they've both won 14, drawn 1, lost 2, all very impressive. Chelsea have scored 50 goals, City have scored 45, and there's only 3 goals as well between them in terms of goals against. So on pretty much every metric, they are locked in. But is the sense, watching week in, week out, that one looks more likely than the other?
No, I still think it's really hard to call. You know, Manchester City have just won their 11th game in a row. But Chelsea, at the business end of the season, still fighting on four fronts, know how to get the job done. So it does actually make it really difficult to call. Chelsea still have to play Manchester United. Man City still have to play Arsenal. So there's still potential slip-ups along the way. And as I say, the goal difference, plus two. So actually, it's probably the hardest season to call. You know, many saying it will probably go down to the last game of the season. But the way that things have happened across this season, there's been unexpected slip-ups kind of across the league. So, you know, it could potentially be decided before that.
Chelsea, we should say as well, are looking for their fifth successive league title, hence your point, they know how to get it done at the business end. And this is, of course, Emma Hayes' final season in charge as well. So there's that emotional aspect to proceedings for Chelsea, I would think.
Yeah, and, you know, I'd actually argue, should they go on and do it and win the league, it would probably have been the hardest league and for them to have won of all the ones they have won under Emma Hayes. You know, not only are they fighting Manchester City right to the end, but they've had to contend with some major injuries in the squad. And I know they've got a lot of depth, but I guess that's what the depth was there for, fighting in four competitions, right? And they're still managing to maintain that. But, you know, losing your star striker, losing your backup striker, having the last minute striker you brought in January for a record fee get injured a couple of weeks ago at kind of a crucial time, it's a lot for them to have to deal with. So they've been juggling it pretty well.
The Chelsea journey at this point centres around Hayes in many respects. She turned up initially and didn't have an office and sort of built the thing from the ground up. And maybe because she was so successful, or maybe because Chelsea would do it anyway, to be fair, would have done it anyway, they invested and have built a bit of an empire. I think that journey is fairly well known. What's the Man City experience? They've been in the top four for the last number of seasons, so very much a coming force and plenty of resources and backing, as we might expect, with the ownership.
Yeah, I think they're a little bit later in their journey than Chelsea. So you have to factor that in. But it has been a project, you know, and they've had ups and downs. They're kind of, we see often with them in a season is they'll go on a really good run and then they kind of will have a dip and kind of lose it at the end. And so far, that's not been happening. You know, they've gone on a good run this season again, one or two blips. But I think the consistency that they've managed to maintain this season in terms of signings, you know, a lot of us question the fact that they only really brought in one player with a couple of players going out in the summer, and we wondered how that was going to impact them. But having managed so much turnover last season, that consistency has really paid off. They're a good kind of academy product. They're good at bringing young players through. We're seeing that through the likes of Jess Park now, getting a lot of game time, stepping up in key moments. So it's a long-term project. And I think, you know, they've won it back in, 2016, maybe, I think it was. Mm. They've won a Continental Cup. But they will want more silverware for kind of the investment, I guess, that's going in. They're a little bit always the bridesmaid, if you know what I mean. Yeah. You know, coming up short, particularly around Champions League, always getting knocked out by a Spanish team before really getting their teeth into it. So this could be a turning point for them in their journey, I think.
Excuse slight ignorance of the question, but I'd be curious to know, obviously in the Premier League, we're seeing increasingly the teeth of the profit and sustainability rules. When it comes to WSL spending for these clubs, clearly Manchester City have limitless funds. How open is the playing field? Can they spend gazillions and blow everybody out of the water? Or are they very much subject to profit and sustainability rules? Or what dictates spending limits in the women's game, where clearly their money would go a lot further as well? I mean, if they wanted to plough 100 million into their women's team, they'd probably win the league.
Yeah, I think, you know, there is still a big disparity in terms of what money clubs have to spend within the league. You know, the top clubs are able to invest a huge amount. But also, you know, they're not paying players hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pounds. You know, there is a bit more management around that, but they're able to facilitate things like you've got clubs that can offer housing, that can cover their food and their training and all that kind of stuff, which was sounds really obvious, like that should be something clubs should cover, but actually still only relatively 5-6 years old where clubs are able to provide that. You know, you only recently still had clubs having players in shared accommodation and stuff like that. So in that respect, there are some of the areas I think that clubs have been able to take a step ahead. Investing in proper facilities has been a massive area for Manchester City. Again, I touched on that academy. That's an area off the pitch that they've massively invested in, you know, having their own stadium. I know they share with the academy team as well, but those kind of things are areas that they've invested in, and that, and now you're seeing the fruits of that.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big part of their success.
Okay, so it's very much self-imposed spending limits, I guess, within the confines of profit and sustainability. So if a club were of a mind to, if a Premier League club were of a mind to, they could conceivably say, do you know what, we are going to cut the spending on the male side of things by 8% and all of that money is going to go into the women's team, and that would probably win them the league within a season or two if they were of a mind to do it. They could direct funds that way.
I think there's a bit more control over it in the women's game, but arguably, yes, a club could decide to reduce their spending on the men's side and put more into the women's game. I find that
hard to visualise.
It's a hard one to get wrap my head around.
Yeah, so it's more of a self-imposed thing, I suppose, but improvement gradually, if not rapidly. A couple of weeks ago, I found myself watching Spurs-Arsenal at the Emirates. Katie McCabe right back. Oddly, it's always odd to see her there. But like, the crowd's amazing that Arsenal are getting. What's the general scene at the moment, Rachel, and what tends to dictate who's getting big crowds, in your opinion?
Well, you know, there has been a big increase in crowds year on year. The WSL has actually surpassed their record number of season attendances a couple of weeks ago already. So we are seeing, off the back of major tournaments, there has been an increase. Arsenal still very much leading the way. But there has been a steady growth across other clubs. You know, your Aston Villas, Bristol have been doing a really good job in terms of getting people into the club, into the stadiums, I should say. It's a balance of marketing, getting the marketing right. I think that element of the game would still be relatively young compared to the men's, you know, working out who the audience are, moving away from this, it's a family friendly kind of vibe. That is one aspect of it. But I think clubs are going more down the route of focusing on football fans, fans of the club, and trying to get them in as well. And that, I think, is having an impact on the numbers we're seeing. Your Chelsea's, your Arsenal's, even when they play at home, are generally packing out their stadiums pretty regularly. Same at Manchester City, getting good numbers, and Manchester United. So I think it's that growth of marketing, commercial. But Arsenal kind of got it right, I think, where it comes to engaging with fan supports and fan groups. And building it around that. I think their journeys in the Champions League have also helped that growth as well. They've always been very good with travelling fans,
right.
Which is something that's still relatively new within the league. So, yeah, it's been an interesting growth. It maybe lags behind a little bit in terms of other areas of growth, but it is an area that is impressively growing, I think. And I think the more we see Arsenal do what they're doing, the more other clubs are desperate to catch up and learn from them.
Yeah, well, I mean, they must be looking at some of the scenes from the Arsenal games and thinking, oh my God, this is absolutely extraordinary. We're way behind. Because I did see the attendance at Goodison for Everton-Liverpool recently wasn't amazing. I mean, so following various reporters of the league, some were putting it down to, yes, marketing, but also the absence of any lioness in the game. I didn't know how true that is. I mean, obviously, you nobody can say for sure, but I guess Annie Lioness is a big marketing tool in the local area. But for whatever reason anyway, Liverpool at Goodison didn't seem to capture the imagination in a way that I'd say they're looking at Arsenal Spurs going, oh God, we've got to replicate that.
Yeah, but what's unusual is the same fixture last year on Women's Football Weekend drew over 20,000 to the ground. Okay. It was a Friday evening game. So I think kind of the noise around Women's Football Weekend didn't feel like it was as loud this time round. I don't know whether it's a combination of whether it's club interest in kind of building this weekend and capitalising on the fact that it's an international break in the men's game, using the main stadia, the club's stadiums. Or, you know, got to factor in Everton's budget issues at the moment could have also played a part. But yeah, I was a little bit disappointed at the number at Goodison Park, because 1 p.m. on a Sunday, you would think, is an ideal time.
Yes. And I don't know, was it deliberately or not, but a Merseyside derby as well to appeal to the entire city was nicely placed in that weekend. So
yeah, that's often what they try and do around Women's Football Weekend, is try and get some of those derbies in, those big clashes in, to try and really capitalise on getting, you know, the big stadiums used. I mean, you look across at Manchester and they got over 40,000. So I do think there is an interest there. It's just whether they've had the capacity, Everton, this season to really focus on that, I'm not really sure they have.
Mm. And in terms of the coverage generally, Sky Sports have obviously thrown their weight behind it in a very big way. And I know you're on the Koi Gig podcast this week. And so, you know, those kind of things just weren't there 5 years ago. Girls on the Ball, very much included. In terms of mainstream, how we talk about it, I'm conscious even in a conversation like this. On the one hand, I'm very conscious that a lot of the audience aren't watching WSL week in, week out, and would, you know, enjoy those more basic questions I'm asking you, which you're thinking, God, you know, who cares about that? Let's talk about the goal at the weekend in that particular match. So in terms of trying to hook in the wider audience, I'm wondering if anything about the coverage at large strikes you as being good, bad or indifferent.
I've actually really enjoyed Sky's coverage, because they've just treated it like they would a men's game. We're getting much more analysis than I think we may be used to.
Right.
It used to frustrate me in the past, where sometimes coverage would start maybe 15 minutes, half an hour before a game, and sometimes lack that in-depth analysis. I think Sky have really committed to that really well. And BBC have started doing more of that. But, you know, in Sky, in the studio, they've got your graphics boards and they're doing their replays and they're highlighting the certain players and the certain gaps and all that kind of stuff. And I think that tactical insight had been lacking over the years. So that's something I think I've really enjoyed. We're still seeing, you know, I guess, in terms of the coverage post-Euros, post-World Cup, and the success of the Lionesses, I probably expected more. I thought we'd start seeing packed-out press boxes. Would we get accredited for games? That's not something that I've really seen translate. There are spikes around the big games. And I think, you know, with newspapers at the moment, we are seeing numbers cut, and I do think women's football coverage has been in some ways impacted by that. But I think that's more of a wider problem than a women's football specific problem. But we are seeing much more of an increase in things like your podcasts and digital coverage. I do think there's been a big spike in that. And I think, you know, we don't necessarily have to go down the traditional route the way that other sport has been covered. There are opportunities to expand other ways to engage audiences. And I think I saw a report around the kind of 13 to 25 year old demographic is one of the hardest demographics to target when it comes to live sport. And that's an area that has been really popular in women's football. So it's, I guess, a different way of targeting that audience. So it's interesting, but and it is growing. But I think other factors do play a part in terms of growing that coverage in like your mainstream media.
Yeah. That's interesting about the 13 to 25 age group. So it does seem to have really captured that family aspect. I presume the 13 to 25, they're probably kids who were going with parents, and then maybe they're getting a bit older or still going with parents perhaps. Or why do you think women's football has done well in that area?
I think the way that clubs have capitalised on the personalities they have in the squads, you know, that younger demographic want to get to know players. We're starting to see that age group now could grow up and be footballers. And I guess, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, that demographic didn't have that opportunity, didn't have many athletes to look up to. That wasn't really a potential route that they could go down. And I think that's an element that's been well captured. You know, we're seeing players on the big stage, on their own platforms, speaking out about various different things. And I think that's something that a lot of that demographic can aspire to. Plus, they're just getting involved in sport. And I think, like you said about Lionesses, that's a big area that's captured yeah. a lot of that audience as well. Getting to go and see World Cup stars and Euros winners down at Boreham Wood or at a local, you know, a smaller club, I guess makes it feel a little bit more accessible. I probably wouldn't bracket them in that family vibe. I think that kind of demographic, or the traditional demographic around women's football, where we talk about that family friendly, is more your kids younger than that age and the families. But, you know, that 13 to 25 demographic is the one that's growing into loyal team fans. And that's a really interesting one to watch.
Okay. And sorry to put you on the spot. Do you have a breakdown in that age group? Like, are 13, 14 year old boys going to these games every bit as much as the girls, or is it female heavy?
I don't have a breakdown, unfortunately. It was something I saw off the back of the Euros, and it's that kind of stat. It was a report I saw stuck with me, purely as someone who's worked in digital marketing for 10 years and kind of knowing the importance of understanding the different demographics. It used to really frustrate me about women's football that it was quite like one demographic focused. And I think it was an area that probably, you know, debilitated that growth of the audience a little bit because it was so single fan orientated. And I think that area, as I said, is what's growing now. They're starting to break up the demographics and not just target young kids. At the end of the day, those young kids are not the ones putting their hand in the pocket and buying a ticket or a season ticket or choosing to go and travel and watch a team in the Champions League. So that kind of grasp and commitment to marketing has massively helped, I think, in recent years.
Yeah. And is it their sense that the best avenue to grow this exponentially is to leverage the support for the men's team, i.e. you're a Manchester United fan, and so therefore you're fairly gettable and we can get you to support the women's team as well? Are they seeing that crossover happen, or is there any way to even know if that's how they've hooked someone in initially?
I think you are seeing some of that crossover, and that is one avenue that clubs target. I think some clubs can maybe be a bit lazy and just rely on the badge. I think that's something that's going to grow their fan base. But there is a newer audience available to them as well, because I think women's football, you see a lot of fans that are probably more likely to go to multiple games rather than just the team they support, which I think is quite unique.
Right, yeah.
You know, during the Euros, fans be going to all sorts of games, not just England, which I think, again, is quite a unique thing. Often fans will have a second team or a second national team that they really like because they follow the players' journeys.
Yes.
They've seen them play at their club, they've gone somewhere else, they've kept in touch with how they're doing. So that's another element that I think is quite unique. So yes, there is an element of drawing in fans of the men's club, but that shouldn't be the only way you focus, because I think you can grow the women's game in a different way. I think, you know, there can be potential to be lazy and just kind of keep on doing what you do in the men's game and just expect it to transfer.
Yeah. So maybe it's less toxic and tribal, which is an interesting thought, you know?
Yeah, like we are seeing much more rivalries and, you know, the growth in those, you know, chanting at players or booing players. And you want that, like you can enjoy that type of rivalry and you want to grow that in the game because fans like that will travel, which means you get more people at opposition games, all that kind of stuff. So that is an area I think we can grow, but I think we can still maintain, you know, that friendlier stand, or you could put your families in a different area. We can kind of cater to all of those audiences, I think.
Very good. Okay, listen, fascinating. Sorry, I threw you about 10 very hard to answer questions there and you've answered them all brilliantly. So we appreciate it, Rachel. And like I said, you're on the Koi Gig podcast, getting into the nitty gritty of the action in a bit more depth this week as well. So Rachel O'Sullivan from Girls on the Ball, as ever, pleasure. Thanks a mil.
No problem. Thanks for having me. Cheers.
Football on Off the Ball.
With William Hill. Who you got? 18 plus. See gamblingcare.ie.
This is News Talk.